welcome everybody. You're all very welcome along to this lunchtime session. Switch off your mobile phones if you haven't already done so, please. There is an attendance sheet which is working its way over from this corner, so make sure to sign that before you go back today to get the all-important CPD. So we have a great topic today for you, the application of preservation regime to defined benefit pensions. It's a really technical subject and it's nice to take a bit of time out and think about this in a little bit of detail. We have a good speaker for you today. Ian Devon has agreed to talk to us. He is a partner with legal firm Eversheds Sutherland. He advises companies, government departments, state bodies and trustees on all aspects of pensions law. He's a former chairman of the Association of Pension Lawyers in Ireland. He sits on the Irish Association of Pension Committee's Defined Contribution Committee. And I'm told that he is ranked as a band one lawyer in the Chambers Europe Guide. So I had to check that out for myself today to find out actually what is a band one lawyer. And according to Chambers, law firms and individual lawyers are ranked in bands from 1 to 6, with 1 being the best. So we're in good company today. So no pressure, Ian. Okay, so as I said, a really technical subject. It's good for, I suppose, one thing that Ian said to me is, surely all you guys know this inside out. I said, no, don't assume that. And it's important for us to take a step back once in a while and just understand the regime from a sort of a higher level perspective, but also to delve into the detail in particular areas. And that's what Ian is going to help us with today. So on that note, I'll ask Ian to come up and begin the talk.
Thanks, Roma.
Afternoon, everyone. So as Roma says, when she first proposed this topic to me, my take on it was, well, really, this is an actuarial area, and pension lawyers are kind of bit players when it comes to preservation. But I suppose as you work through preservation, you do begin to realise there's actually a broad mix of actuarial and legal issues that come into play. So in terms of how I propose to deal with it, as Roma says, plan is to sort of go through the basics, a lot of the key concepts at a fairly high level, firstly, and then look in a bit more detail at some of the tricky and technical issues that come up in the context of scheme restructurings and how preservation interacts with those types of transactions. So looking at the basics, I thought this was a good place to start. How is an entitlement to a preserved benefit, how does it arise? As many of you know, the Pensions Act came in 1990, and prior to then, there was no statutory protection for early leavers benefits. It really turned on the rules of a scheme, whether a deferred benefit that a member had left behind on leaving service was protected or not. So in 1990 that changed with Part 3 of the Pensions Act coming in, and this concept of a preserved benefit, a statutory protection for the benefit that was left behind. So when does it arise? Well, technically it arises on the termination of relevant employment, otherwise than on death, prior to normal pension age, i.e. if you leave service prior to normal pension age, basically. And it's subject to satisfying a qualifying service condition, which at one point in time was 5 years qualifying service, two of which had to be after 91. But since June 2002, the bar has been lowered, and it's a two-year period now of qualifying service in order for that entitlement to arise. And the Pensions Authority's own guidance on this makes the point that not only you regarded it as being in relevant employment when you're a member of a scheme, but when you're actually capable of becoming a member of a scheme, you're in relevant employment in those circumstances, even though you may not have joined. And that definition of relevant employment, as we come to see, is very important as you work through preservation. The Pensions Authority itself explains that relevant employment is deemed to have terminated not only where you leave service, but also where a scheme is wound up or frozen but not replaced, so at a point in time when there's no scheme applying to the employment. Also where a member declines to join, the Pensions Authority's guidance indicates that that's a situation where relevant employment has terminated, or where a member opts out of membership of a scheme. So when does it not arise, I suppose, is also an important question. Obviously, it doesn't arise where you might go in temporary absence, but you're still in membership of the scheme. You may not be accruing reckonable service, but you're still in an employment to which the scheme applies. And it doesn't arise, which we'll see is relevant to the context of scheme restructurings, where you might have frozen the scheme to approval or wound it up and offered a replacement scheme. And that is significant in the context of restructurings. So I suppose having established whether an entitlement has arisen, what are the consequences? So I've mentioned a few of the main consequences there. Obviously, preserved benefit, you as actuaries will all know, it then falls to be calculated in line with a fairly prescriptive schedule that's set out in the second schedule of the Pensions Act. I suppose us as pension lawyers, we never really see the ins and outs of how that calculation is done. We just see the output of it in terms of benefit statements and leaving service statements and so forth. So we're a little bit blindsided to see on some of the issues you probably have to deal with in doing those calculations. I suppose one significant legal point here is that under Part 3 of the Act, the preserved benefits payable in accordance with the rules in force at date of leaving. So the rules that exist at the date of leaving are sort of hardwired and hardwired into that preserved benefit calculation, which can be a challenge because over time scheme rules get amended, so you're then into trying to establish, well, what rules are in force and what benefits existed at date of leaving. Section 50 does, I suppose, give you the opportunity to amend that in one respect, because Section 50 will override that particular aspect of preservation, so that a Section 50 direction can alter how a preserved benefit is calculated. Another significant consequence from a member perspective is that a refund of contributions is prohibited. So I suppose there may be situations where a partial refund can arise if a member has pre-91 service or has left with pre-91 contributions there. But generally, the rule is that member contributions are prohibited. Refund of member contributions is prohibited. As many of you will be aware, and it's something we'll want to look at, the concept of revaluation applies to a preserved benefit, and we look in a bit more detail at that, as well as an entitlement to a transfer payment is created once a preserved benefit is created. And I suppose a legal point here, and one we would find ourselves, looking at from time to time, is that this notion that once a preserved benefit is created, the forfeiture or employer lien type provisions within a trust deed are disapplied. There is an exception there on a bankruptcy situation where trustees may continue to operate a forfeiture provision, and that is something post-Crash Ireland, we've seen schemes seek advice on from time to time, but it's just another consequence of the preserved benefit being created. So I suppose this is really the pure actuarial bit in terms of how the preserved benefit is calculated. And the second schedule, I suppose, splits the calculation into four elements. You have your basic preserved benefit, which is the long service benefit times this fraction. So the way it is calculated really is it's the retirement benefit a member has built up at date of leaving, assuming they stay to normal pension age, multiplied by this fraction, which is their actual reckonable service post-1991 over potential reckonable service. I mention phasing in there, and it's something we'll come on to look at a bit more closely later on, because if there's been any changes in the basis of calculating long service benefit during the member's time in the scheme, there's a more complex calculation that then applies, so that the benefit changes is phased in over time and needs to be recognised as part of that calculation. The next layer is AVCs, so if the members paid AVCs into the scheme, they're part of the preserved benefit, and if those AVCs are funding a benefit on a defined benefit basis, again, there's a calculation that needs to be done, expressed as X times Y over Z. This one, I suppose, I haven't seen it calculated in practice, and as far as I can gather, just reading through it, it's really based around the portion of APCs that the member has contributed, assuming they stay to normal pension date, again, times a fraction, which is their reckonable service over potential reckonable service. Any transfer payments are then included as well. And since June 2002, anyone leaving service, there's recognition of their pre-1991 service in the calculation. And again, this is another one where lawyers reading those calculations, it just doesn't really jump out at you. It's immediately obvious how the pre-91 benefits are brought in there. But again, I suppose we just see the output of those calculations. And then that preserved benefit is, as you know, revalued annually in line with Part B of the second schedule. Which brings us into, I suppose, revaluation and how it works. Revaluation would have been brought in the mid-90s to introduce an element of inflation proofing for preserved benefits. It basically applies to preserved benefits created after January 96, where a member is at least a year from normal pension age on leaving service. And the preserved benefits revalued annually by the prescribed revaluation percentage. So the Minister has power under Part 3 of the Act to make statutory instruments and to prescribe a revaluation percentage annually that applies to the preserved benefit. And it's basically, traditionally had been CPI capped at 4%. But since January 2013, the Act was amended to allow the Minister declare a revaluation percentage which reflects any increase or decrease in CPI capped at 4%. And there is facility within that legislation, that change was made, for the Minister to increase the 4% cap to smooth the effects of negative revaluation. And the benefit, the revaluation process then ceases on payment of the preserved benefit or where the member reaches normal pension age or death. So, that change, I suppose, generated a lot of activity when it was brought in. A lot of schemes found themselves, I suppose, grappling with an issue where, under their rules, they may have had a leaving service rule which prescribed that they would increase preserved benefits by the revaluation percentage. And what, therefore, must they do if the Minister declared a negative CPI revaluation percentage? And it was debated among the pension law community for a while, and the consensus arrived at really was that if you had a set of rules that said increase, that it wasn't safe for trustees to then reduce benefits to reflect the effects of deflation, essentially, which then prompted employers to say, well, that's not what we planned at all. This feature of the scheme is really there to reflect statutory revaluation, and if the law has changed and we now have a situation where deflation can occur as well, scheme rules need to be amended to reflect that. And I think most trustees accepted that argument, and a lot of schemes have been amended to remove the word increase and include adjust or revalue instead. Because really, the idea is that those provisions within pension, these are there to reflect the revaluation process under the Pensions Act. Briefly then on transfer payments. Transfer payments basically reflect the actuarial value of the preserved benefit with an allowance for revaluation and contingent death benefits, obviously calculated in line with Pension Authority's own prescribed guidance and the Society of Actuaries guidance. So again, this is another area where actuaries very much own it. We just see the output of those calculations. I suppose from time to time we have had issues where advice has been sought, particularly in the context of wind-ups where transfer basis being used is something other than the funding standard basis, or situations where following a scheme going into wind-up, a member has been divorced, let's say, and then there's a debate around, well, whether an allowance needs to be made for contingent death and for spousal death and retirement pensions and so forth. So those sorts of issues crop up from time to time. The transfer payment under legislation can be reduced to reflect any funding deficit. Interestingly, the word may is used there. So it's trustees have discretion. They don't have to reduce transfer payments to reflect funding deficits, but in practice they always are, really, because as fiduciaries, to not reduce them obviously depletes the fund. So unless the employer is topping up the transfer value in some way, trustees effectively pass through that reduction. And from a member perspective, what does the entitlement to a transfer payment mean? Well, it essentially means that members can direct trustees to effect transfer payments to another occupational pension scheme, be it funded or unfunded, to PRBs, to PRSAs, and just one point to be aware of, we still have this unusual 15-year rule where if you've been a member of a scheme for 15 years or more, PRSA transfers are off limits. And there's an ability to direct transfer payments to overseas pension vehicles. And just on that, I'll throw out an issue we came across in a transaction recently, where an employer had proposed the wind-up of a DB scheme and the transfer of its assets and liabilities to a Belgian IORP, essentially a Belgian occupational pension scheme. And the proposal, the way it was structured, was that on wind-up, the trustees would effectively force transfers of member benefits across to the Belgian structure, relying on their powers under the Pensions Act. But when you actually dig into it and look at the provisions in Section 48(3) of the Pensions Act, which give trustees the power to effect forced transfers on wind-up, they don't cover effecting a transfer to an overseas pension vehicle. They do cover Irish vehicles, all right. That said, they don't preclude it either, so you've essentially a gap in the legislation here where there is no power at a statutory level to effect a forced transfer overseas, but you're not prohibited from doing so. So in that particular case, the trustees approached the Pensions Authority on the point, and the Pensions Authority accepted there was obviously a gap here, and their take on it was that members, if this is proposed, members should be given the opportunity to meaningfully consent to any overseas transfer. And in the end, that was dealt with by way of essentially a passive consent. Members were, the default on wind-up was that members went across to Belgium. They did have an opt-out right and an opportunity to exercise that right within 30 days or more. It probably ended up being 2 months, really, to give members the time to understand the change. But it was just an interesting sort of inconsistency between Part 3 and members' rights in terms of directing trustees to transfer, and then Part 4 of the Act in terms of trustees effecting forced transfers on wind-up. There was just a disconnect there that was interesting. The statutory right to take a transfer payment only exists for 2 years after leaving service, but trustees can extend it, and I haven't come across a situation where trustees have sort of refused to extend. But that technically the right has lapsed after 2 years. And I suppose just to mention as well, in terms of forced transfers, it's something we are seeing employers begin to look at, that there's this facility under Part 3 of the Act to effect forced transfers, for trustees to effect forced transfers for small pots with a value of under €10,000. So I suppose that's probably seen by employers as low-hanging fruit in terms of liability management of DB schemes, but the challenge is to persuade trustees to go there and exercise that power. Moving on then to look briefly at how preserved benefits are treated on death. The basic rule is the actuarial value of the preserved benefit is paid out to the estate. However, if you have a scheme that provides spousal or dependents pensions on death in service, it is possible for trustees to instead pay out such pensions as opposed to paying the actuarial value of the lump sum to the estate. And on one or two occasions, that is, I suppose, an area we find ourselves coming in to advise on, because I remember one example, the contingent pension had a value in excess of the actuarial value of the preserved benefit. So the trustees sought a bit of advice around what is the correct thing to do in those circumstances, given that two values didn't match. But generally, this is, I think, an area that it's probably dealt with purely between trustees and their actuarial advisors. So just coming to the end, I suppose, on on the basics, two final concepts to run by you. First being enhancement. Very similar to revaluation, it just arises in a slightly different way, and it arises where a member leaves relevant employment with periods of reckonable service in more than one scheme of the same employer, and it occurs once relevant employment terminates. And again, it's calculated in the same way as revaluation, but the difference is it covers the period from when reckonable service in the first scheme ceases to the date relevant employment terminated. So the idea, I suppose, is if you leave a DB scheme, your reckonable service in the DB scheme has ceased, you've joined a DC scheme, and if you subsequently leave the DC scheme, the idea is enhancement will apply to the frozen DB benefit, covering the period from when they left the DB scheme to when they left the employment. And then that enhanced preserve benefit becomes subject to revaluation. So the basic idea is that they're treated as service in separate schemes with a preserved benefit calculation, with a revaluation calculation applying to them as if they were separate preserved benefits. As we see in the context of accrual freezes, that creates its own complication. And then finally, on just wrapping up on some of the basic concepts, phasing in, I don't know if it's fair to call it a basic concept. I find it highly complicated, but it basically arises where the basis of calculating long service benefit is altered between commencing and terminating relevant employment, i.e. a benefit change has occurred while in membership of the scheme, and the idea is the funding cost associating with that benefit change is phased in after the date of change and only fully crystallises once the member reaches normal pension age, except where you've made a change to normal pension age, there is a 10-year phasing period there at a maximum. So it creates this, I suppose, anomaly in some ways that if a member leaves prior to normal pension date, their preserved benefit will not reflect the full impact of that change, and that is why it becomes so topical in the context of accrual freezes and so forth. So I suppose that's a run through the basics, as I call them, in terms of preservation, and just propose now to look at what we call the complex stuff, what arises when you get into accrual changes. So in terms of accrual changes, the one we come across most common, particularly over the last probably 5 years or so, is what I call a full freeze, where the link with final salary is broken and all accrual under the scheme has ceased. This throws up, I suppose, two main issues I want to look at, the first being the revaluation issue. As I suppose many of you experience where schemes go through a full freeze, typically there's no break in relevant employment because as soon as the DB scheme is frozen, there's a DC scheme members move across to. So if there's no break in relevant employment, there's no preserved benefit created, so there's no revaluation. That all sounds fine in theory because we've enhancement here to sort of deal with this. An enhancement will apply on a member subsequently having a break in relevant employment. So the frozen benefit will then be subject to enhancement, and that enhanced benefit then gets subject to revaluation after the member has left relevant employment. But what if actives stay onto normal pension age? So what if you have a situation where the scheme has been frozen to accrual, you've active stay on to normal pension age, the frozen benefit sits there, it doesn't ever become subject to enhancement or revaluation. So as a trustee being asked to agree to this change, you have an issue because, let's say it's a big enough change to agree to in the first place because it's taking DB accrual away. But then you also have the complication of, well, we've deferred members who will have revaluation applied to their preserved benefit, and we've potentially a cohort of active members who won't have their frozen benefit uplifted in the same way. And the solution, the common solution that has been sort of developed over the last 5 years or so is what I've called contractual revaluation, and by that I mean simply writing a revaluation provision into the rules of the scheme so that the active members at date of freeze have their frozen benefits subject to revaluation as if they have left service. So essentially you'll have one deed of amendment freezing the scheme fully to accrual with this contractual revaluation provision included, thereby ensuring actives and deferreds are treated in the same way. And what has, I suppose, cropped up in a lot of these transactions recently is trustees seeking to have some sort of floor put on that revaluation. And this is driven by the fact that we now have negative revaluation potentially under Part 3 of the Act, and trustees seeking to secure as many concessions as they can for active members as part of negotiations with employers on this type of change. So it's that sort of fiduciary obligation that is driving trustees to seek to put a floor on contractual revaluation. And employers commonly agreeing to concede as part of getting the accrual freeze through. The other big issue that crops up in this context is phasing in. So a full freeze, as we know, is a change in the basis of calculating long service benefit. You've gone from DB accruing to DB no longer accruing. Typically, you have no break in relevant employment, and that's because people go across to a DC scheme. And that's significant in the context of phasing in, because if you had a break in relevant employment that coincided with this change, what you then have managed to engineer is a situation where members have effectively left relevant employment at the date the benefit change was made. And if that has happened, then there's been no change in the basis of calculating long service benefit during their relevant employment in the scheme. So where you have no break in relevant employment, you don't have that, you can't make that argument. So phasing in does arise. And then added to that, you've this risk or concern that by writing contractual revaluation into the scheme, at some level, is that a continuation of reckonable service? Because the benefits aren't fully frozen. There is an element of uplift there in line with revaluation over time. And is that a continuation of reckonable service? So because of that concern, workarounds have been developed, and there are a few of them I'll take you through now. And at an employer level, you might ask, well, why is an employer interested in engineering a workaround? Well, the natural reason employers are interested in this is because there's an economic cost, a financial cost to them if the benefit change and the funding costs associated with it cannot be realised immediately. So employers are looking to realise these funding savings immediately. They don't want them phased in over time. So they're very keen to come up with a way to prevent phasing in applying. Trustees then would rightly ask the question, well, why do we have to engage with the employer in engineering some sort of a workaround to phasing in? Surely this is just a consequence of the law of the land. This is the way the Pensions Act operates. And tough, employer, tough, if that's the way it works. But there is a fiduciary angle to this for trustees to consider, because I suppose by allowing phasing in to just simply operate, what you have potentially is an inequity between actives who stay to normal pension age and have the full benefit change phased in, whereas actives who might leave prior to normal pension age, who would then get an uplift to reflect the portion of the benefit change that has not been phased in. And that usually, that trustees usually sort of see that as a basis to actually engage with employers on this and look at workarounds. So on the workarounds, I've thrown up there what I've seen in practice. Some of them have been implemented, some others I haven't seen implemented, but I've seen them debated as solutions. And a lot of them are really focused on either, I suppose, doing one of two things. You're trying to engineer a break in relevant employment or a break in reckonable service. And the reason a break in relevant employment works is that then you have no change occurring. You've no change in the basis of calculating long service benefit during the member's period of relevant employment in the scheme. And the proposal there that I've seen floated is that this idea is of a gap between leaving the DB scheme and joining the DC scheme. So they leave the DB scheme, there's no scheme to which that employment then applies. There's a gap of a month or so, and they join the DC scheme. So in theory, that probably works, but you run into some practical issues because most schemes will offer death cover through the scheme. So there will be a scheme, to the extent there's death cover continuing during the gap, there will be a scheme applying to the employment, so you've no break in relevant employment. So you're faced with the decision of allowing death cover to lapse, which isn't really practical. The other challenge is actually communicating why you have a gap to employees. I think for the advisors and technical experts, communicating phasing in is a challenge in itself, never mind going to a workforce and saying we're not putting into the D scheme today because we're applying a phasing in calculation to the benefits we do and we don't want to do that. You've lost people, so it's, let's say, it's not one I've seen used. I've seen it debated, and I think it just has these practical challenges which sort of render it useless at this point. The other way is creating this break in reckonable service so that once the freeze has been implemented, there's no reckonable service after that date, so there's nothing to phase in. And the favoured way at this point of engineering that break is to essentially do your deed, fully freezing the scheme to accrual, writing in contractual revaluation, and having done all that and implemented the change, trustees notifying members that service following the freeze does not entitle them to long service benefit. And you might ask, well, what's so significant about that notice? Well, that notice takes advantage of one of the exceptions to what constitutes reckonable service within the definition of reckonable service. So reckonable service is basically membership of a scheme during a period of relevant employment, except where the only benefit accruing is a death in service benefit, or trustees have issued the members with one of these notices. The pension story is aware of this approach. We were involved in one case, I think last year, where the trustees' advisors sought to get some assurances from the pensions authority that no phasing in would arise in this context. The pension authority's response was along the lines of recognising that there is this ability under the definition of reckonable service to issue such a notice, but that it can't be issued in circumstances where it's artificially trying to deny people a long service benefit entitlement or deny them reckonable service. They didn't comment on whether contractual revaluation is a continuation of reckonable service, but I suppose that gave sufficient comfort in that case that in principle that the pensions authority recognises that these notices can work if you have a valid situation where there's no reckonable service really accruing. The other solution I've seen in a couple of cases in terms of breaking reckonable service is to have two deeds instead of one deed. And the way this is, I've seen work is that you have an initial deed, fully freezing the scheme to accrual without writing in contractual revaluation. So you have essentially a clean, I suppose, deed of amendment, fully freezing the scheme, followed by a period where there's no reckonable service, so there's no debate over reckonable service continuing, and then a second deed later in the same year where the scheme rules are amended to write in contractual revaluation for actives who are in service on the date of freeze. I think that approach has probably fallen out of favour a little bit. The other approach is much more popular now and one we've seen in practice. Legally the cleanest way and the most clear-cut way to get around phasing in is to actually implement the freeze via Section 50. Section 50 contains provision in it which makes it clear that a Section 50 direction overrides the phasing in provisions of the second schedule. There are various reasons why employers particularly aren't keen to go the Section 50 route in terms of getting around phasing in. The fact that you're locked into, a more de-risking approach on investment and the added costs that go with that from an employer side, mean that Section 50 isn't really seen as a valid alternative or a feasible alternative unless you're also doing some form of benefit reduction. And I would just flag the need to frame the Section 50 application accordingly, that you're making it clear in the application form itself that you're seeking to have the direction cover phasing in as well. The final two workarounds I've mentioned there again, are to do with creating this break in reckonable service. I've seen them proposed, but trustees reluctant to go down and adopt them. The first is to, again, full freeze by way of a deed with no contractual revaluation written into the rules, and instead augmentation is applied on the member retiring, leaving service or dying, and the employer funding for revaluation. So at a trustee level, I suppose the concerns that have been raised are that trustees are then relying on employers in years ahead to actually apply that augmentation. There is no contractual revaluation entitlement under the rules, so there's a bit of uncertainty there. So why would we expose members to that uncertainty? Similarly, the other solution whereby you would make contractual revaluation discretionary with the employer promising it to employees outside the scheme. Again, we have seen trustees sort of wary of this because there's any number of reasons why an employer promise outside the scheme may or may not be enforceable, and the preference is to see contractual revaluation written into the rules. So just to wrap up then, briefly mention pensionable service freezes. I have not really seen these in practice in a number of years. I think you're much more likely to see a full freeze or a cap in pensionable salary, but again, you've no break in relevant employment here because there's still the final salary link, so there's still a scheme applying to the employment. You do have this change in the basis of calculating benefits, so you will have phasing in. And the only workaround I really see here would be to use Section 50 because relevant employment is continuing. You also have reckonable service continuing, so very hard to see what workaround other than a Section 50 there. And then the pensionable salary cap, this is one I suppose we've seen much more commonly, with the salary essentially being capped and accrual continuing. Again, no break in relevant employment with accrual continuing. You do have phasing in given the change in how benefits are calculated. Could be worked around via Section 50. But one scheme last year we saw actually implement this, not by way of a deed of amendment, but by way of notification, so the members are all advised that pension salary is now capped. And the pensionable salary definition in that particular scheme allowed this change to be implemented by way of notification, because pensionable salary was whatever salary that was notified by the employer to the trustees on a review date, less the social welfare pension offset. So what was agreed was that the employer would simply notify the trustees of the 2016 pensionable salary figure into the future, and as the state pension offset got bigger in line with increases in state pension, the employer would just simply notify a notional higher pensionable salary amount, so that when the higher offset applied, you find yourself back to the pensionable salary that existed in 2016. So that workaround is doable depending on the rules of your scheme. It was possible there because of how pensionable salary was defined, but it may not be possible in every case. So I suppose that's a run through preservation and how it applies on in the context of accrual freezes. So I'm happy to open it to the floor to questions now.